This episode is brought to you in association with Janus Henderson Investors. It is for promotional purposes, is not for onward distribution, and the value of an investment can fall as well as rise. Past performance is not a guide to future performance, and nothing in this episode should be construed as advice. Our discussion is for illustrative purposes only, and references made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase the security. Hello, hello, and welcome to Janus Henderson's Big 5-0 mini-series podcast, aiming to help those who have reached the Big 5-0 or are nearly there and perhaps realizing that they need to start planning and investing for retirement. Throughout the series, we're going to talk to a mixture of retirees, financial advisors, and professional investors to find out why it's essential to start saving through your pension as early as possible, how easy it is to get started with one, the different options you have available, and the types of funds you can use to start investing for your future. Today, in episode 3, we start to solidify some plans and find out what options we have when saving for retirement, including the different pension options available, the tax benefits they bring, the sorts of assets you should be investing in at the age of 50, and why investment trusts, one of the best kept secrets in the investing world, might be a great option for getting you over the line. To help us examine these topics today, I'd like to welcome financial advisor Lisa Conway Hughes and director and head of investment trusts at Janus Henderson Investors, James de Summeres. Lisa, let's start with you. Do you want to give us a little bit of a background to your career as a financial advisor?
So I started in the industry straight from university, and I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And I'm now a chartered financial advisor. I'm a fellow of the PFS. I was one of the youngest to actually do it at that time. I did that when I was in my late 20s. Although as a financial advisor, you tend to help the wealthiest people in society, I'm really, really passionate about making sure that everyone gets a financial education. So I started a blog 10 years ago now called Miss Lolly, misslolly.com. And that's really just gone from strength to strength. And now I run the Ladies Finance Club with my friend Molly as well. And we look after thousands of women, educating them about money.
So would you say it's helping lots of women? That's what you really love about being in the industry?
I do find that women tend to be under-resourced, and we know that women obviously have the pension gap, the pay gap, investment gap. We've got lots of things stacked against us, so it's led me down that path.
Is there a particular approach that the firm takes when it comes to planning and investing?
I think the most important thing is that we're independent, and then it's about finding the right advisor for you. So there's 40 advisors, so I think it's about looking at all the different advisors and finding the one that really speaks your language, because hopefully your financial advisor and you have a very long-term relationship.
Yes, of course. Okay, well, let's get on to thinking about retirement at the age of 50. And I wanted just to lay a bit of groundwork in terms of the planning side of things. So let's start with, you know, can you change the outcome of your retirement much at the age of 50?
Yeah, definitely. And it's not too late. You might not get the retirement of your dreams. I think you might have to become realistic about the age that you want to retire. You might have to make some compromises, either now in the ability for you to pay in, or later on in life if you're going to have that little bit less.
What if you don't have a pension at all?
Then start. I think it's a great way for you to be building up money and getting the government to help you contribute at the same time. But I think the first port of call is to work out, well, what actually is it that you want, and what do you have, and what's that short for?
Okay. And then just thinking about, you know, the different ways in which we fund our retirements, a lot of people will think, well, I've got my property, you know, I can sell that. That's a good way to fund retirement. Is there a reason why you might go for a pension fund rather than using your property to fund it?
I think it's all about having bits of everything. So having pensions and ISAs are going to help you to invest in a tax efficient way, and also to help you control the amount of tax that you pay in retirement. Property, the benefit being that when you sell your home, that's completely tax-free. But I think in reality, when you get to retirement, you don't feel old. So you don't want to downsize straight away when you get to retirement. And I tend to find that a lot of my clients never end up actually downsizing until it's sort of the care home stage. So I think you've got to be realistic about, will you actually downsize? At what age will you want to downsize? And what does downsizing mean? How much will actually be released when you take into account the buying costs as well?
And I guess in a similar vein, you know, there might be some entrepreneurs out there who are relying on selling their business. I suppose that's quite a risky approach.
There is an element of keeping your fingers crossed that the economy's right at the time that you want to retire, that there's a buyer out there for just the price that you want. So for clients who have got their own businesses, we plan as if that's never going to happen, and then that's the icing on the cake, and that's the definitely not having to downsize. So I think it's all about having that base plan, that sanity plan, so that you're not worrying, but also that you're not in a needy position when you're coming to sell as well. You can wait for the right time to sell rather than having to, because you don't have the money without it.
Okay. Okay, well, let's get on to some of the funding routes that we have for retirement. And very broadly, there are three types of pension: state pension, the workplace pension, and private pensions as well. So let's start with the state pension. How does this work? How's it funded?
So as a broad brush, you need to have 35 years of national insurance contributions to get the full state pension. If you aren't born in the UK, or you've only got a very small amount of national insurance contributions, the minimum is 10 years. So if you came to the UK, say, for 8 years and then went back home, you're not going to qualify for state pension. You'd need to be here for 10 years to qualify to be able to then take that state pension with you back home. But yeah, 35 years is the amount that you need to do to get the full state pension. And there's a rough rule of thumb, the state pension is always about 9,000. It's funded by the government, it's funded by taxpayers, the pot that we all contribute into, and at the moment it's protected by this triple lock, and the triple lock is the way that it's guaranteed to increase every year. Whether we can afford the state pension with this generous triple lock going forward, and I always worry about it, I'm in my early 40s, and I would always worry that it's not going to be there when I get there. I'm planning as if it's not, and then if I do get a state pension, then all the better.
Okay, because this is one of the guarantees in the triple lock is, you know, it goes for the highest, and one of them is inflation, correct? Which is why these promises are hard to keep at the moment. Okay, so the state pension is one option. Then the workplace pension. Now, presumably this is the main pension that people tend to build. It's certainly grown massively since auto enrolment was introduced in 2012, is that correct?
Yeah, so I suppose the benefit of auto-enrolment, it's taken that decision out of whether or not to be in the workplace pension for most people. Obviously, you can opt out of it, but it automatically enrolls you in, hence the name. So I think the introduction of auto-enrolment has really, really helped. It also means that we have lots and lots of different pots scattered around, especially if we're moving jobs. So I think it's important to stay on top of those pensions. Make sure you're signing up for your online access if you're moving house and things like that, because these pots do go missing. And I would say very commonly clients sort of say, I don't think there was anything from that pension when I was in my early 20s or my late 30s, whatever it is. We track it down, and actually they can be quite sizable. I had the most extreme example of that I've had is, I had a very lucky man who had been very remiss in his pension planning. He said, I think I've got a couple of hundred grand. Can you track it down? And it took me over a year, I kid you not, trying to track down these old pensions from the 80s and 90s. And in the end, he had over £1 million in pensions. Now, I know most people aren't going to be lucky as he was to find that much. But also, it's very common to find 20, 30 grand pots when people just have dismissed them. So the government has got the pension tracing service. And so I really would urge all the listeners to make sure that they aren't losing those pots and they're staying on top of them.
Okay, so let's just, before we get on to that, let's just get on to some of the basics of the workplace pension. There's defined benefit and defined contribution. Do you want to explain the differences between those two?
Yeah, so the clue is in the title. So the way I remember it's defined contribution means you know what you're going to contribute. So you'll pay in, the employer will pay in. It will then be invested, and what you get out depends on how well or badly those investments have performed. Defined benefit means you know what you're going to get out at the end. You know what the benefit's going to be. And these are the lucky people that tend to have final salary pension schemes, career average pension schemes. These tend to be people who have either been with a company a really, really long time, or you work for the NHS, you're a teacher, police person, you work for the government, those kind of places. The risk, you have to pay in and into a defined benefit contribution pension. You have to pay in, but the risk of providing that benefit to you is on the employer.
So they sort of died a death, didn't they, DB schemes in the private world, but in the public world, there's still quite a lot of them around, right?
Yeah, there are. And I mean, I see them regularly with new clients that we take on. But you're right, not many people are currently in a workplace defined benefit scheme if they work for a company rather than the government.
OK, so on to the more common then DC scheme. So you pay a bit in, your employer pays a bit in, and then the government give you a little top up as well. Is that right?
Yeah, believe it or not, the government contributes to your pension. So if you're a basic rate taxpayer, the government's giving you back your basic rate tax, which is 20%. So you pay in 80, the government pays in 20. If you're a high rate taxpayer, that goes to 60 from you, 40 from the government. And if you're paying into a pension yourself, it's really important to make sure that if you're a high rate taxpayer, you do a tax return, because the pension companies are just assuming everyone's a basic rate taxpayer, and then you have to claim the excess back.
So the additional relief comes through the tax return when you put it through. Okay. And what happens if I want to add more to it? Can I do that?
Yeah. You, believe it or not, you can collect as many pensions as you like. You can add personally. You can add through your employer as well. There are some limits, though. The government doesn't want to give away too much tax relief. So in the current world, as long as you earn less than £240,000 a year, you can pay in up to £40,000 between you and your employer into a pension. And then there's this lovely thing, which I seem to spend every March calculating, is people's carry forward. So you can go back to the last three tax years. So you go back to the furthest tax year first and see, were there any allowances that I didn't use? And you can bring them forward to the current year.
So if you had 2 years that you hadn't paid in any, then you could scoop that all forward and have a much bigger allowance this year.
Yeah, there's always a rule when it comes to pensions. So you can bring forward the allowances as long as in the tax year that you're bringing forward, you had a pension open. Doesn't mean that you had to contribute. So often, a really good example of this is I had a lady who set up a recruitment business. She's been so focused on that recruitment business, hadn't paid in anything to her pension ever. And we went back to the last three tax years. But to be able to do that, we had to go and find her first graduate pension scheme that she paid in for 6 months just to prove that she had one, and then we could use that carry forward. If she hadn't have had that graduate pension, we wouldn't have been able to go backwards.
Okay, interesting nuance there. Okay, fine. So that's the workplace pension. Then there's the private pension, which, you know, people may have heard of SIPs, self-invested personal pensions. So do you want to just explain a little bit? I mean, there's a few types of these: stakeholder, and then there's a private, and then there's a SIP, which is full fat. Do you want to explain the differences between these?
Yeah, so the stakeholder pension, you don't really come across them that much, because they were brought around originally where the government would cap the amount of charges on a pension, depending whether you were 10 years in or not, at either 1.5% or 1%. But now pensions is a very competitive environment. So you tend to find that those charges are quite high on a pension these days anyway. Then you get the private pension. Private pension, you could be either a GPP, which would be a group personal pension, or just a PP, which is a personal pension. It depends on the provider. You'll get some types of pensions that have got maybe 1, 2, 5 different funds to pick from. And then you'll get some personal pensions that have got access to hundreds, if not thousands, of different of funds. So I think it's worthwhile finding what kind of private pension do you have. And then I think people come to me and say, I want a SIP. And they SIP seems to have just, I think people think, well, that's the posh kind of pension, so I'll have it. And they don't really know why. And traditionally, when I joined the industry in the early 2000s, a SIP was in its purest form. A SIP tended to be a fixed contract, fixed fee SIP. So if you've got lots of money, a SIP could end up being cheaper. If you've got a small amount of money, it could end up being more expensive. And it was for using for things like buying your office in, buying specific things in into the SIP for more sort of complicated investments. It's all sort of merged into one. So I think really now the difference between a SIP and a personal pension really just depends on the contract.
Okay. And is it easy to open and manage these things?
believe it or not, behind all the jargon, pensions are actually really easy. So you've got really three decisions to make. One, do you want to use an advisor or not? If you're going to use an advisor, I would urge everyone to pick somebody independent and someone that you like. The next decision is, who's your provider going to be? There's so many resources out there online for you, to help you narrow down which is going to be the best provider for you. And the best provider is going to be a provider that's got good online access, presumably in today's world, down to the costs and charges of the policy, but also the access to funds. So if you're someone who, say, wants to invest ethically, does that pension provide you with sustainable options that are suitable for your needs? And then once you've chosen your provider, you're then going to want to choose the investments. And a lot of the providers now will have these ready-made solutions, so you can opt into their ready-made solution for the investment side of thing, or if you're really interested, you can do it yourself.
Okay, and how would you, I mean, we've talked about some of the tax benefits there, how would you summarise all of them? Because it's also this, it's been able to grow your capital free of taxes, correct?
Exactly. So if you think about pensions before retirement, when you pay in, the government pays in your tax. So the tax that you've paid on that amount of money at your highest rate. Therefore, pensions are a great way to very legally control the amount of tax that you're paying in any given tax year. And in some cases, you can even, by your pension contribution, move down a tax bracket. So paying in is great because you get your tax relief. Pensions then grow tax-free. It's only on the outside, when you're retired, that you actually pay tax on pensions. You get 25% of your pot is tax-free. 75% is taxable, and you can either take that 25% out on the day that you retire and have a really good year, or a lot of my clients do it this way, is we take slices out of the pot every year, and 25% of that slice is tax-free, 75% is taxable. So when you're taking money out of your pension, you've just got to really plan ahead and be careful that you're not putting yourself unnecessarily into a higher rate tax bracket because of the slice that you're taking. And that's where ISAs can come in and be really, really useful at supplementing pensions, because when you spend an ISA, it's tax-free. So if you've got in your armory pensions and ISAs when it comes to planning your retirement, you can take out the amount either up to the nil rate tax bracket or the 20% tax bracket out of your pension, and then top yourself up with your ISA tax-free. So having both is really, really important.
So that 75% that's taxable, that will be taxed just like any other income, basically, when you retire.
So the first 12.5 is tax-free, roughly up to 50 is 20%, over that gets to 40%, and then, well, if you're over 100,000 in pensions in retirement, it gets quite expensive.
Okay. And then in terms of, you know, funding this sort of spending once you retire, you can just take that money and spend it as you wish, or you can also buy this thing called an annuity, right?
So you can do what I said, so you can take your slices out every year and spend it. The downside to that is you've got to trust yourself not to overspend. And it's really tricky with clients, because when you're young in retirement, you want to be doing all those things like the holidays and the big spending and enjoying your life. But you also need to make sure you don't overspend too early so that you run out of money. And if that's a concern, let's say you've got £1 million in your pension pot. You could take that £1 million and give it to an insurance company and buy what's called an annuity. And based on your risk, your age, where you live, your health, whether you smoke, whether you don't, they'll say they'll give you a guaranteed income for life for X. So let's say the £1 million pension pot, let's say they did, and this is a very high rate, but let's say they said, we'll give you 50,000 a year. If you died after 10 years, you've only had your £500,000 out of your pot. If you live for 25 years, you've kind of won the bet against them. So it's about looking at what rate would they give you. And I think a lot of people have been deterred from buying annuities recently because that rate has been so low, mainly because it's influenced by the gilt yields, which are low.
Okay. And then, of course, you can mix and match those options as well.
Exactly. And I think a really good approach is, if you think about it, from 67 or 68, depending on your age, you're going to get the state pension. So let's say that's 9,000. But let's say we know that your fixed outgoings and your bills are 20,000 a year. You could buy an annuity that gives you the 11,000 a year income. And then things like fun, holidays, and all the extras in life could come from your other pot. So I think creating that safety net and that sanity net is really important in retirement, especially if you're a worrier as well.
Just before we speak to James on the investing side of things in just a sec, I wanted just to get from your perspective the sort of the shape of your portfolio in terms of assets. So there are many different assets that we can invest in. The main ones are shares and bonds, I suppose, but there's also other stuff like property and alternatives like commodities and specialist strategies like hedge, etc. So what, you know, if I'm 50 years old and I'm trying to think about the funds that go into my portfolio, what kind of should asset allocation look like, do you reckon?
It's not possible to just answer that with a this in equities, this in bonds. It's, you've got to think, well, when do I want to spend this money? So if I'm 50 and at 60, I want to buy an annuity, I know that in 10 years time, I want to be in cash. So I'm going to be really nervous about the volatility of the market for the next 10 years. So I might be more cautious. Whereas if I was going to take this slice approach and I was going to spend that money down over my lifetime, hopefully I'm going to live very happily until my 90s. So some of that money is not even going to be spent until then. So even though I'm 50, some of this money could have another 40 years to be invested. So it's, you've got to consider your time frame, but you've also got to consider your personality. So it's thought that we feel the pain of a downside twice as much as we feel the positive of an up. And so if you're a real worrier and you're going to be having sleepless nights, you've got to make sure that you get that balance right between the way that you invest and the volatility in the market.
Okay, Lisa, one final question for you. What are your thoughts on investment trusts as a retirement solution?
I think they're a great part of a portfolio, and I think most people don't know what they are. I think some people would say an investment trust when they mean a unit trust and vice versa.
Lisa Conway-Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So to help us examine these topics today, I'd like to welcome Director and Head of Investment Trust at Janus Henderson Investors, James de Sumeres. James, welcome. So James, you lead the Janus Henderson Investment Trust team. So what's the number of trusts you have?
Well, we manage the assets of 12 investment trusts.
Okay. And have investment trusts always been a big part of your career?
It certainly has, Marcus, yeah. I started in the city in 1981. I actually joined an investment firm called Touche Remnant & Co. in January 1986. That was subsequently acquired by Henderson. So I've been involved with investment trusts for well over 35 years.
Okay, well, I certainly know that you think investment trusts are a great retail fund. Let's get on to some of the features that make them unique from the open-ended funds, as they're known, which is a much, much bigger part of the industry. Let's start with diversification. Now, this is where they're both similar, isn't it?
It is where they're similar. And I mean, I'd go a little further than you and say they're the best form of structure for an investor. Diversification is a key part of it. An investment trust is a company, and it's a company like any other company, like Marks and Spencer's or Shell Transport and Trading. But instead of owning shops and holding stocks of clothes and food, it actually invests in the shares of other companies. And so when you buy a share of an investment trust, you're buying a share in a whole load of other companies. And that provides you with a nice spread of risk and good diversification. So I think that's a sort of key thing. But because an investment trust is a company, it has a board of directors. And that board of directors is wholly independent from us as the investment management company. And they provide an absolutely invaluable and, I would suggest, unique governance role in terms of making sure that we do the job that we need to do for shareholders. So that they will challenge the fund manager, they will encourage us, they will engage and discuss, and they will make sure things are done. And above all, they negotiate fees, which is why you often find that investment trust companies have a lower fee base than open-ended equivalents.
Okay, that's interesting. Are there any other advantages of using investment trusts?
Investment trusts have other advantages. It's because there are companies, for example, they can gear. That's borrowing money with the view of getting a better return than the cost of that borrowing. And investment trusts are able to do this. And given that interest rates have been so low in recent years, this has been a very attractive way of investing, because quite often there's a simple arbitrage between the cost of the debt, which may be as low as 1.5-2%, and the income that you can get from investing in the stocks. So, you know, gearing has its risks, because obviously it's a double-edged sword. As markets go up, it'll enhance the return, but as markets go down, it will enhance the loss. So there is a double-edged sword, but remember, it's a professional investment manager who's managing the portfolio.
Do most investment trusts gear, or are there ones that sort of don't go near that feature?
Well, it's a key benefit or feature of an investment trust. So I would say that most investment trusts do tend to gear, but some of them don't. Some of them don't. It does vary from investment manager to investment manager as to how comfortable they are. But given the investment trust structure offers the opportunity to gear, then it does make a lot of sense. And I think gearing makes particularly good sense over the very long term. If you stay invested through the cycle, with your gearing, you can get a good return. And that's why many investment trusts have long-term gearing in place.
Okay, so we've got an independent board and also the ability to gear, potentially to enhance returns. What about the revenue reserve? What's this?
Well, because it's a company, companies are able to put some of the revenues they earn each year into a reserve. And what this does for an investment trust is it enables the investment trust to smooth dividends over time. So by in the good years, distributing most of the income, certainly at least 85% has to be distributed. But they have the option of putting a little bit of what's left into reserve. So if there's a year when dividends are tight or scarce, then they can dip into those reserves and make sure shareholders, you know, continue to enjoy either the same dividend or even still continue to grow dividends. One of the great areas of pride in the investment trust industry is the length of periods over which we have continually increased dividends on an annual basis. And of course, the most successful of those companies is one of our own, which is the City of London Investment Trust, which has increased its dividend every year since England won the World Cup. For those of you who are into football, for those of you who are not, that was 1966. So that's 55 years.
Wow, that's quite incredible. And if you're interested in finding those trusts that have those long dividend records, including the City of London, the trade body, the Association of Investment Companies, has their Dividend Heroes, of which City is one of them. And they're the trusts that have been growing them for more than 50 years.
Yes, I mean, the Dividend Heroes actually covers all those that have been growing them for more than 10. So you'll get quite a wide variety of companies if you look at the Association of Investment Companies website.
Okay, brilliant. And then premiums and discounts. This is a bit of a feature that you need to get your head around as well, right?
Yes, it is. But it's something that I would recommend private investors don't take a lot of notice of. Basically, because an investment trust is a company, the price of the shares of the company are not determined by the underlying net asset value of the company. That is the total value of all the investments the investment trust holds divided by the number of shares gives you the net asset value. Now, with an open-ended fund or a mutual fund, that the price would be determined by that net asset value. With an investment trust, because it's a company, the price is determined a little bit by the supply and demand for those shares. So that may mean that the shares trade at a premium or, more usually, a discount to their net asset value. Now, the truth is that if you're investing in the medium to long term, which is the right period over which to invest in investment trusts, so at least 3 years, but preferably 5, 10 or longer, actually the difference between your buy discount or premium and your sell discount or premium is a very small part of your return. What's really important is to make sure you invest in a company with a good fund manager who's going to perform well.
Okay, and then the final feature I wanted to touch on is just the fact that they have this closed pool of capital. So open-ended funds will grow and shrink, concertina basically, as money comes in and out, whereas investment trusts go at one particular time and raise an amount of capital and then have that fixed. Why is that an advantage for the fund manager running those investment trusts?
Well, I think that if you have to fund redemptions, that's people who want to sell their shares, then an investment manager is always going to have to hold some cash. And with, you know, interest rates at a very, very low levels, cash is not a very attractive investment. And you can't get the same sort of returns than you can when you're fully invested. So an investment trust can stay fully invested. I think the other benefit is that investment trust managers can take a longer-term view of some of their investments. Because if they know they haven't got a redemption stream to worry about, they can perhaps invest in a slightly more illiquid or smaller company, which they know they can hold for the long term, and they're not ever going to be put into a position where they have to sell. Of course, investment trusts do grow, and they do shrink from time to time, because an investment trust can issue shares on what we call a tap basis, or they can buy them back. But you're quite right, it is a closed pool of capital, and that fundamentally lets the fund manager take a longer-term view of investment.
Okay, I want to get on to the retirement question. Why do you think they're well-suited for retirement?
Well, I think they're well-suited for retirement. And by retirement, I don't mean for those who are retired. I'm talking about people right through the cycle. Whether you're 21 or whether you're retiring age 65, it actually doesn't make any difference. Investment trusts are really good for your retirement investing. In the early part of your life, when you're saving for retirement, and I think one of the things people should bear in mind most is that a lot of people in their 20s think, oh, I can worry about my retirement later. I'm only 23. I'm only 25. I'm only 27. But actually, the earlier you start saving for your retirement, the longer that money has to work for you. And you want to invest it and hold it right through and it can work hard for you. And investment trusts provide a very good investment platform for doing that. You invest in the company, the company's invested in a wide range of things, and you can just leave it to the professional manager to manage it, and then you can look, if you're a younger person, at the total return. Now, obviously, as you get older, as you get above 50 and you start thinking about retirement, you want to then perhaps look at moving your portfolio around a bit to invest in some of those investment trusts which offer slightly higher yield, a bit more dividends, because there's going to come a point when you're going to say, I'm going to retire, I now need to live off my pension, and ideally what I want is for my pension to give me enough income that I can continue to enjoy the lifestyle I've always lived. I mean, everyone's primary objective in retirement must be to maintain the standard of living they enjoyed when they were working. So that's quite important. So you can move from trusts that are very growth orientated to trusts that are a little more income orientated as you move towards retirement in your 50s. And investment trusts have this advantage. And of course, you know, some investment trusts offer quite attractive income with good capital growth, and we call those total return companies, and they're great for the whole cycle. But obviously, as you approach retirement, there are some trusts that specialize in income and high income, and we certainly manage a few like that, and they're ones that people actually touching retirement or in retirement will find particularly attractive.
So when you're a little bit younger, you've got some of those growth strategies that with investment trusts are probably going to be boosted by a bit of gearing. And then as you get towards your retirement age, there's plenty of income strategies which are supported by revenue reserves, I suppose.
That's exactly right. And that then sort of means you've got a reasonably certain level of income. I mean, the point I would make, and I think a lot of investors need to remember, is that, you know, investing in the stock market, which is what investment trusts are about, does involve risk. But you should remember that risk is proportionate to the time period over which you're investing. So the longer the time period over which you're investing, the risk to your capital diminishes. So if you're in your 20s and you're saving for your retirement, you're looking at 40 years ahead, 35 years ahead. And so you can invest in things that have a lot of growth potential, but may be more volatile. Because over that 40 years, that volatility will smooth out and you'll get a very nice return. So younger people should be looking, you know, at core investments, you know, global growth investment trusts like the Bankers Investment Trust or UK trusts, because, you know, obviously we're sterling investors. But they can also look at things that are more what I call growthy. So things, you know, like UK smaller company investment trusts or European smaller company investment trusts or even technology trusts. So, you know, there are a lot of opportunities for people to diversify their portfolios with a lot of different things. But when you're younger, you're looking at achieving the best growth you possibly can. As you approach retirement, you're looking for a little more balance and perhaps a good bit more income, because that's what you need to enjoy your retirement.
Okay, James, I just wanted to finish on Janice Henderson's suite of investment trusts. Why do you think investors should take a look at those?
Well, I think we've got a good spread of high quality investment trusts that have been around an awful long time. The Bankers Investment Trust, which is our global growth investment trust, and that's managed by our head of equities, and has a number of his best fund managers looking after different sleeves of it, which for any investor has got to be pretty attractive, because all of those sleeve managers, you know, report through to the head of equities. So they really want to impress him. And that's a great investment trust, because the Bankers Investment Trust is a trust for all seasons. It works very well for you when you're young. It's a good core investment, but it's great when you're older as well. And, you know, for anyone who's looking not at retirement, but actually at, you know, their children or grandchildren, then it's great for junior ISAs and things like that. So it's a really good core investment. But then we've got other investment trusts that appeal. So for those ones at the younger end, you know, we've got a UK investment trust called the Henderson Small Companies Investment Trust. You know, we've got a European Small Companies Investment Trust. You know, which are quite interesting. We've got some sort of total, what I call total return type UK funds, you know, City of London Investment Trust, Lowland Investment Company, which do interesting things. And then Henderson Opportunities Trust, which is a small investment trust, which invests right at the bottom end of the UK market in very small companies, which is much more volatile than anything else. But over the long term, actually, is really interesting. And for those in retirement, you know, our two most popular investment trusts are actually Henderson Far East Income Investment Trust, which I think has the highest yield in the whole of the investment trust sector, and Henderson High Income Trust, which is a UK-based high income trust. So, you know, wherever you are in your retirement cycle, I think we at Janus Henderson have got something of interest to you. That's not to say that there aren't other trusts of interest to you managed by some of our competitors. Everyone needs a good spread of investment. But, you know, you will find trusts of interest, whatever age you are, within the Henderson Investment Trust stable.
Okay, well, on that note, I'd like to thank James de Summerez and Lisa Conway Hughes for their time today and taking us through how we start to apply our plans and the options we have both in financial planning and investing. Next time, we'll focus more granularly on the investment choices we have to make in crafting the perfect retirement portfolio at the Big 5-0. Until then, goodbye. This is important information, not for onward distribution. Before investing in an investment trust referred to in this podcast, you should satisfy yourself as to its suitability and the risks involved, and you may wish to consult a financial advisor. This is a marketing communication. Please refer to the AIFMD disclosure document and annual report of the AIF before making any final investment decisions. Past performance does not predict future returns. The value of an investment and the income from it can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested. Tax assumptions and reliefs depend on an investor's particular circumstances and may change if those circumstances or the law change. Nothing in this podcast is intended to or should be construed as advice. This podcast is not a recommendation to sell or purchase any investment. It does not form part of any contract for the sale or purchase of any investment. We may record telephone calls for our mutual protection, to improve customer service, and for regulatory record-keeping purposes. Issued in the UK by Janus Henderson Investors. Janus Henderson Investors is the name under which investment products and services are provided by Janus Capital International Limited, registration number 359-4615, Henderson Global Investors Limited, registration number 906-355, Henderson Investment Funds Limited, registration number 267-8531, Henderson Equity Partners Limited, registration number 260-6646, each registered in England and Wales at 201 Bishopsgate, London, EC2M3AE, and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, as well as Henderson Management S.A, registration number B22848 at De Rue de Bitburg, L1273, Luxembourg, and regulated by the Commission de Surveillance du Secteur Financier. Janus Henderson, Janus, Henderson, Intech, Velocity Shares, Knowledge Shared, Knowledge.Shared, and Knowledge Labs are trademarks of Janus Henderson Group PLC or one of its subsidiaries. Copyright Janus Henderson Group PLC.